That's why I'm here, isn't it? For doing surgeries. His black eyebrows knitted together, and his irises shifted in such a way that Marvel felt he was being untruthful. There are no walking doctors in Kansas. There are, because I was there. Marvel gestured for Juniper to come closer to the bars. Does he come from Kansas? Do you know him? Juniper spread his hands. His eyes went to his knife, still in Marvel's belt. I'm not from Kansas. Marvel laughed suddenly. Oh, of course. He gestured to the prisoner's earholes. Your personal misfortune interests me. I would like to know more. The prisoner smiled coldly. I couldn't possibly. I think you should stay right here for now. Marvel checked his paper again and memorized the prisoner's name. He felt Juniper at his back in a way he had not moments before. Were these two in collusion? How could either of them have known Marvel planned to return to Kansas? Or were they here for another reason? But Marvel was overwhelmed by the desire to be away from them both. There are larger fortunes at stake here than your own. You will be tortured if you are not forthcoming when I return, he said. I would hate to do it. He paused. For at least a moment I would hate to do it. But I must know the name of the man who took your ears. And why? He could not say anything more in front of Juniper. The prisoner, Tygo, shook his head and they left him there, gaping slightly like an askew window pane. Juniper tagged behind Marvel, taking longer steps than befitted a man of his height, but nevertheless keeping nearly apace with Marvel as he stalked down the hallway, through the gauntlet of wretches spitting and screaming. Marvel couldn't care less about them now. When they passed the jailer, who was now nodding off in his chair, tilted against the wall, Marvel kicked the leg and barked, Up! Let us out! I haven't got time for this! In the courtyard again, Marvel tried to breathe calmly of the coming winter's salty air, but instead he felt a lurch of nausea. He saw his chance for escape diminishing. If the Mystagogue lived, and obviously he did, Marvel would die in this peacockish hellhole. He would live out his remaining years serving the wrong denomination, the wrong king. It would be the closing off of his soul from salvation forever. He could not allow it. He had lived 51 years serving the wrong cause. No longer. He was a monk. In his heart, he was a priest, not a king, a hierophant, a soldier, or a malcontent. What he wanted most was to go home. Juniper had taken a deep breath of fresh air when they exited the jail, pulling a rag from his tunic to wipe his face. The fabric came away damp. An upswell of panic he tried and failed to hide. The young guard was most definitely a spy. Marvel considered having him thrown in the jail, but he had dealt with spies before. They were often more useful than otherwise, if one knew how to manipulate them. At least Juniper was nice to look at. Marvel, composed again, asked, What did you think of the prisoner? Probably not a walking doctor. Probably not. Or a carnival man. No, Marvel said. Juniper said, I'm not from Kansas. I want you to know that. Marvel nodded. You sound sure of yourself. Juniper turned and stared up at Canaveral Tower behind him, squinting in the gray light of mid-morning. Look, all I can say is the truth. There are many truths, though. Watching Juniper look up to where the Pardoness lived in her suite of luxury, Marvel had a strange idea. He was beginning to realize he was a desperate man. That earless prisoner had reminded him just how awful the Watchtower had been in those days, and probably so remained. And yet still Marvel longed to return, now more than ever. There was a way, though it would be violent. Blood it must be, everywhere, and in everything. Wonder blood, the primary law. This time at least, he would ask forgiveness. If the Mystagogue lived, then he must be killed. Marvel Parsons, a killer from the age of 14, would see to that unpleasant task once again. Chapter 3. The Executionatrix. They had come finally through the drear of autumn and burst onto the whitish plain of Florida, with its weed scrap and blood smell, and even as they crossed into the tropics, the girl knew she was home. Now she did not think any more of running away, but sat quietly on Mr. Capilaccio's bed in his red wagon as it bumped without rest along the safe road on wooden wheels, and she listened to the jingle jangle of his hanging charms. The sound soothed her. Nights, as they camped, she would watch him at his desk, writing and writing. In the warm red light from the lantern, she could see he was troubled. His lips angled downward and formed a wrinkle just above the square of his chin bone. But when he turned to her and smiled, all his worries seemed to dissolve. It was a smile that contained trust, and within his trust there was also safety. And inside that safety, the girl felt growing the beginnings of her own power over him. Sometimes she remembered to be afraid. If they were caught returning to the Cape out of season, it would mean more deaths in a world that was already overflowing with death. But she didn't desire any more to escape Mr. Capilaccio, who had rescued her from certain death. She saw that now. He had scooped her up before she'd been killed in battle, or wandered lost into the country and contracted the disease and died a shivering, chattering husk. Had she run off alone, she might have walked across one of 100,000 fields still harboring the blood sickness. Her mother had said the disease was a predictable consequence of the derelict society that produced it 1,000 years before. Everyone called it the bent head death, and no one wanted to die of it. The girl had once gone with her mother to the bedside of a dying woman. The woman, dark-skinned and old, had wild eyes and thudded her head in an endless rhythm against her driftwood headboard. Thump, thump, thump. The teeth in her mouth clacking almost angrily. The girl's mother could do nothing, because there was no medicine on earth that could reverse the progressive spongifying of the brain due to the consumption of contaminated meat, which was what bent head was. Her mother believed that she and a few other walking doctors were the only people left alive who knew what actually caused bent head. As far as they were concerned, there never had been a cure. Ever. They could find no mention or hint of one in their books. The best her mother could do was euthanize the woman and remove the brain for study. Bent head was a dreadful way to die. Victims were transformed into angular, famished horrors. They could not be buried, as the fluid seepage contaminated the land for an eon. The girl did not understand science or magic, or even if they were different from each other, but she knew it was Benthead that had somehow brought Wonderblood into the world, and Wonderblood was the law on which all the other laws were based. It decreed that this purge was inevitable and sacred, and that until all lands were rinsed at the cosmic basin in clean and virtuous blood, there would be no end to suffering. Her mother scoffed. The religions had it all backwards, she said. More blood on the land just kept contaminating it, and so they were now locked in an endless cycle of blood and sickness. But when the girl told that to Mr. Capilaccio, he called her mother a faithless wretch who placed her trust in surgery instead of religion. Who could surgery save? A single person? In a lifetime, how many? A few thousand? Wonderblood, the executions, could save them all. Eventually. Her mother's impatience was a great sin. Didn't she see that? Didn't the girl see that what they were doing was for everyone's good? And the girl could not at these times keep herself from marveling at the force of his belief. He spoke with such magnetism that she yearned to listen to him, even when she did not understand. He answered questions she had not even known she was asking. At last, they made their camp outside the Cape compound's walls. Mr. Capilaccio's carnival was already the mightiest in the land, and functioned with a frightening efficiency. His men could raise it entirely in under 9 hours. His own giant tent was so large it contained his wagon wholly. He and the girl used the wagon as their bedchamber. Outside, men laid planks for walkways. The merchants and charm makers pitched their booths, and just as soon as they finished tying down the last tent pegs, Mr. Capellatio's new great flag was hoisted over the encampment. This was a flag of conquering, he mused to her as he watched it unfurl. His chest rose and fell as they stood together in the tent's doorway. They looked out upon the carnival, and farther away they could see the metal spires of the castle beginning to whirl the morning light back to them, and all around the land was low and flat, and the air heavy, and beyond that began the pink-blue crescent of the sea. "Did you know?" Mr. Capellatio began, and placed his hand upon her small shoulder and gripped the place where the bones knitted together. He pointed to the flag with his other hand. "I began sewing that flag myself when I was young." It was made of 5 deep-colored oblong cloths, each representing a different one of Mr. Capellatio's constituents, whatever those were, all stitched together with golden thread. From afar, it was uncommonly beautiful. Each of its oblong sections was made of some indeterminable color that wavered with a light like a beetle shell. He sighed. "Well, I'm still young, but in my childhood dreamings I saw that flag, and I knew that color was no color, but full of all the colors. That was my destiny. I couldn't sew, Aurora, Queenie, but I sewed it anyway with a needle, a whalebone from this place, from the beaches where I was born. I had the needle years before I had the fabric, or even the idea I should make a flag." He spoke with his eyes closed. "Sometimes it's a person's destiny to carry with him the sharp point of victory, before he even knows what war he will fight. There is a preternatural sense of destiny among us chosen, I think." He rubbed the lump of her shoulder. "Did you have such a feeling?"
"A feeling for what?" she whispered. She was often still afraid to talk to him, especially when he spoke like this. His voice was soft. She found herself leaning into his touch. They stared out at the morning wet landscape, and the girl felt hope stirring inside her. "Hope for what?" she said.
"What kind of feeling do you mean?"
"That you yourself are important." She thought, everyone feels that way, because if you don't feel important, how could a person bear to go on?
"I don't know what important means."
He laughed sharply. "Oh my, I do." Shortly afterward, Mr. Capellatio left to go tramping about his new encampment. "My final encampment ever, Queenie. Glorify. Soon we will live as we have been destined." He locked her inside a cage in his tent and ordered 2 men outside to guard her. He told her as he shut her inside that this cage had been constructed to house his treasures, and she was his most treasured treasure. And now, especially now, he could not let anyone steal her away. She was the future. She was the rightful queen of Cape. He placed a lock the size and shape of an orange on the cage door and clasped her fingers through bars and twined them around his own, and leaned forward and looked into her face with his clear eyes, the color of shallow creek water. "You are so beautiful," he said. "Truly, you are a gem rock." He turned and dropped the key into a skin bag that hung from his belt, but spoke again before leaving the tent. "If I were a stronger man, if I were less mindful of the ways of other men," he began, running his finger down the golden fringe that edged the tent flap. The length of his fingers always surprised the girl, and also they were thin and somewhat yellowish, but from what, she did not know. Tobacco or an illness or some magic substance he touched in his workings. She liked those fingers that always touched her so very gently. They had, in their time together, become something she looked forward to. He went on, "I would like to know you were safe no matter what, if I locked you up or not." He jerked his head back toward the guards outside. She imagined he might hand her the key through the bars of the cage. They both knew she wouldn't leave, but he stiffened when he heard the men outside laughing softly.
She wondered, as she looked at him, whether he trusted anyone at all. This was wise in a way, and sad in another way, and probably unavoidable. He shrugged and blew her a kiss, and then he went away. The cage was not a terrible place to be. It was made of decorated metal with iron lace flourishes. To pass the time, she slept and read from the book Argento had given her, which Mr. Capellaccio had let her keep. The book was written like a fairy tale, and it had been so long since she'd read anything at all. The true king was full of stories she had never heard. The people in the book followed a religion that was hardly anything like Argento's superstitious worship of the astronauts. Mr. Capellaccio's religion had real scriptures. They had relics from the old times. She braided and unbraided her hair as she devoured the handwritten pages, wishing she might never come to the end of it. But before long, a woman strode in, carrying a wooden basin of blood, which she set beside Mr. Capellaccio's desk. The girl froze. The woman wore tall leather boots. She made straight for the crates of books and papers around the desk without even noticing the girl. She spent a long while bent over his desk, rifling through his stacks of papers, holding a few up for inspection, and then setting them down again. Her back was to the girl, and her light brown hair disheveled but clean, nearly the same color as the girl's, and just as long. As she leaned and stretched around the desk in search of more papers, her foot kept bumping the basin of blood. The girl thought she should say something, draw attention to herself, but for some reason she didn't. The woman had such a fierce expression. She appeared to be searching for some particular piece of information, but other than the papers Mr. Capellaccio had been recently working on, all his books remained in their crates. There had been little time yet to unpack. The woman took a pry bar lying nearby and began jimmying the lid off a crate. Suddenly, she seemed to stiffen. She turned around like she'd heard a noise, though the girl had not moved. Maybe the woman had heard her breathing. Her age was impossible to decipher, 20 or 30 or even older, but her eyebrows were thick and darker than her hair, must slightly. Beneath them, her eyes burned with intelligence. She reminded the girl, for the slightest second, of her mother Gimble. A long moment passed before the woman smiled, a frightening smile, like a grotesque shadow on a wall. It contained many emotions, all of which the girl had seen before on different people at different times, but never all at once together. Anger immediately. A shard of despair. She saw fear, too, in the woman's eyes. The woman set down the pry bar and approached the cage. "Hello," she said. The dimness obscured her eyes, but they were magnetic all the same. The girl stared at her. "Hello." "Well, you are not what I expected at all." "At all," she blinked.
"Who are you?"
She came nearer. She wore a huge necklace of feathers, each one long and brown and green and stained to look like blood. It was very well made. The woman fingered it absently as she stared. The girl wondered if people around here wore such things. No one from her settlement had. "What has David done? What has he done this time? Who are you?" is the question.
"Who's David?"
The woman squinted. She was slight but looked strong, with small, well-formed muscles like bits of rock crystal running along the insides of her bare arms. She wore a leather shirt, and her face was so small and her features so crowded together that the girl thought she appeared to be squinting, even when she was not. Still, there was something lovely about her. Perhaps it was her very appearance of strength. Solidness seemed to gather around her like a wall. "Oh, my. What has he told you? You don't even know his name?" The girl felt her cheeks burn, even though she was not afraid.
"Mr. Capellaccio?"
The woman laughed. Though not much taller than the girl, she seemed to crowd out everything else in the tent. She bent toward the cage, the necklace hanging off her chest, and examined the girl more closely. The girl could see her better, too. This near, Her cheeks were still supple, but the skin around her eyes had tiny fissures like drought ground. The girl smelled a citrus perfume. She swallowed.
Mr. Capellatio took my brother's carnival. Everyone there is dead now.
Except you, unfortunately?
I was alone. My brother is dead.
The words spilled out because she could sense this woman meant her evil.
He says I'm going to be the queen.
The woman tilted her head. How's that?
I don't know.
The queen? Or just a queen? There is a difference. She ran her fingernail through the fronds of a feather on her necklace. But how would you know that? You're just a child. The girl felt her face tighten.
Why are you in our tent?
The woman showed no expression. Our tent? You are an hour with him now?
Says who?
She stepped very close, and now the girl could see into her eyes, which were set deep in her face, and appeared dark in a way that belied their actual color, which was the gray-blue of a rock. But the eyes themselves in the riverbed of her face were awful to look at for some reason, so she looked away, until the woman called her back with a soft voice.
Little one, I'm talking to you. Explain to me this, if you can. Are you a prisoner? Perhaps a blessing and a charm to lend luck to our endeavors? Maybe through your honorable transformation from human to head? Or are you some other part of our great work that is soon to transpire?
Great work?
Hasn't he told you that? The woman smiled strangely. What did he tell you? Anything at all? How awful for you. She paused. Where did you say he picked you up?
The field where my brother's carnival was.
Was it perhaps a battlefield?
Not until he came and started killing them all.
The woman wrapped her fingers around the cage's bars, just as Mr. Capellatio had done earlier. Perched on one finger was a gigantic blue glass ring. I see. And you were just an unprotected fawn, as it were, innocently standing there waiting to be found? In the center of the poisonous continental desert? She looked over her shoulder at the desk and all the books in their boxes, frowning. You were a girl on a battlefield.
I guess I was.
The woman tossed her hair behind her shoulders. That is, at least to my ear, highly unlikely. It is not more likely that he bought you from someone or some ones who were hastening to be rid of you? For their own reasons, of course. She clicked her fingernails on the bars.
No.
The woman's hands were always moving. Now they were on her necklace, lifting and stroking the feathers, which were so glossy and long that they extended nearly to the center of her stomach. She wore a loose tunic, short-sleeved. Her knee boots were constructed bloody-looking leather. Everything on her body was black but the feathers.
Oh,
was all she said.
They stared at each other.
The girl had a very bad feeling, indeed. She longed for him to come back and make this woman go away.
Who are you?
The girl asked again. But the woman ignored her. Her expression was quickly gathering a darkness. Has he told you that you were part of a vision? Her face dropped, and she closed her eyes wearily. The girl thought she had seen them tear up for just a moment before she shut them. One of his visions was of a small girl upon a battlefield who would become queen. But we, or should I say I, had not taken that to mean his queen.
Why not?
Since he is lawfully married to me. He has been since he was 16 years of age. That would mean that I am his queen already. She shrugged. A man can have only one legitimate wife. That makes you something additional. A concubine. What was your name again? She demanded.
It made sense now. Her jewelry. She was his wife.
The girl found her voice.
Aurora is what he calls me.
But what is your name?
I can't remember.
How terrible for you, she murmured.
She spoke very much like Mr. Capellatio himself, with half threats and vague intimations.
she shared his cruel manner of a manipulative child. Still, though the girl saw through this behavior, the intended effect of which was to produce in her a great shame, it worked. She felt suddenly stupid for even trying to talk to this woman.
Well, I was abandoned by my mother when I was a girl, and then my brother died a terrible death I had to watch, so I have no family, so I have no name.
She glared at the woman. Not that I would tell you, anyway.
But she did have a name.
She would never speak it.
It was her mother's name, and her mother had given her over to this life,
whatever it was.
How terrible or angelic of her, the girl did not know. Whatever risks were here, there would have been others if she'd stayed in the settlement with her mother and her mother's new husband, riding out on the safe roads with them to learn doctoring. She was unsure if she had wanted that, or for her mother to become jealous of her youth. But she had not wanted to be abandoned, either. The girl stared now at this angry woman, and felt that she had ended up just as bad off here as when her mother left her with Argento. Her punishment back then had been to be in the carnivals with her lunatic brother. What would it be now?
You're right to keep it to yourself. At least in these times, said the woman. I, for one, wouldn't ever trust anyone with my real name.
Except my husband. She began to smile. Who is apparently also your husband, or so you think.
Have you told David your name?
He didn't tell me he was called David.
Why would he? You're not his real wife.
Not yet.
If you were perhaps slightly more beautiful, I would believe he did love you. But his other concubines have generally been attractive, or at least fertile. Do you have some other talent I am not seeing? Are you particularly good at cooking? Your mother maybe taught you that.
I would teach my daughter to cook if I had one.
The girl scowled. You appear to have only recently, in cosmological time, mastered the ability to walk and talk. Tell me, can you menstruate? It's a fair question for a future queen.
Go away.
She had never bled. She felt ashamed of herself, her body. Her mother had told her how it would happen when it happened, and she wasn't afraid. She expected it soon, but there was the trauma of constant motion to contend with, and her thinness. The woman was nodding as though the girl had said all these things aloud. It was as if she could read minds.
Don't be sad. You can't help it.
She stopped nodding.
Do you wish you were dead?
The girl made a face.
Of course I don't. Who would wish for death? In fact, the girl hadn't wished for death since Mr. Capellatio took her from Argento's carnival.
Not since she'd hidden her eyes when Argento died. She straightened her shoulders.
Many do.
Many have. The woman studied her more closely. It's a fact that I've killed more people than David. I am myself an executioner, an executionatrix. I took my carnival by violence from my own brother when I was not much older than you. In fact, it was a marvelous coup. Very bloody. She looked the girl up and down again. I would even go so far as to say it helped David to love me. He likes a strong woman. Then she shrugged.
How does it feel to be in a cage? I'm here to keep me safe. Not because I'm a prisoner. That's what he said.
Oh, of course. And he always tells the truth. I'm sure you know that. She looked to the ground, embarrassed. The blankets and carpets in the bottom of the cage made her feel like a captive animal. But there had been a needle poke when the woman said she was Mr. Capellatio's wife. The girl felt it growing now, an envy so sharp and tiny she'd hardly noticed. But now it began to burn. This was his wife? This maniac? He had a wife? Other concubines? How many? She couldn't believe she'd never allowed herself to wonder about other women. The pricking oozed inside her like blood under the skin. She made a dark face at the woman, who tapped the orange-shaped lock with a clean, long fingernail.
Oh, dear. Now don't be angry, she said. You can't have thought you were the only one.
What's he told you about me? She squared her shoulders and jutted out her lip. She couldn't help herself. He never said anything about you, or any wife, except that I would be his wife. The woman appeared to think. Finally, she went back to the desk and pulled out the chair and sat down. She kicked the wooden bucket of blood for effect. That's my offering. My thanks to the heavens for his successful return. Do you know how much blood that is? How many people? I've been very busy. It's grotesque. Is it grotesque when David executes people? She remembered Argento's dumb eyes as he was led to the block. Had he been drugged? She wanted to think Mr. Capellatio would have granted him, her, that mercy. She thought of her relief and sadness. She said nothing. The woman began rifling through the papers again, this time with much more urgency. My name is Orchid. She spoke with her head in one of the crates. My carnival is called Loss. This is my tent, and David is my husband. When she looked up, she was angry.
What are you looking for?
A certain book. The girl clenched her hands. She had the very sure, very irrational feeling this book was the one she herself had been reading in her cage only moments before the woman arrived. She had not yet admitted to him that she could read, but he knew. Of course he knew. He could see her eyes fly across the pages of his own writing that he brought into their bed, when he sometimes read it aloud, holding the papers at an arm's length as though this would give him greater clarity. When he hated it, which was all the time, he burned the papers with sulfur sticks in a glass bowl set right between their legs on the blankets. They watched as the papers curled up like a dying centipede. He was destroying every evidence of his failures, no matter how small. He wanted to be very sure no one could ever accuse him of getting anything wrong. The woman rummaged and searched.
Why do you need this certain book?
The girl asked, kicking it as slowly as she could under one of the carpets on the floor of her cage. I had wanted it, so I could record the names and numbers of the carnivals that have met here today on the plain, to support him, to crown him, to defend him. But now I want it to prove to him that he was an error to have brought you here. She eyed her. Grievous error. When she was met with the girl's uncomprehending grimace, she returned to the desk chair. She spun it around and threw her slender limbs over it, sitting like a man but much more beautifully. I am his scribe.
Did you write the book?
Do you know the book I'm talking about? The girl shook her head. Let me tell you a story, since you are just a child. She lowered her voice to a dramatic whisper. The girl could feel herself beginning to hate this woman. Only I trusted him in the beginning, because I loved him. He was just an orphan once upon a time, with strange visions that would possess him body and soul. And I was a girl, not much older than yourself. We had made our covenant already, passionately and many times upon the green grass, in the streams and brooks of the countryside. Yes, we were careless. In our desire to be alone together, we strayed from the safe roads. So you must understand that at first we worried his visions might be a raving illness. Maybe Benthead? Who knew? We were on the land so often, and who could account for his frightening premonitions without at least considering a medical causation? We came from a settlement where they still ate cows. A backward place. Not far from here. Even I wondered if he was sick. I admit my faith was tested then.
We ate cows in my settlement, too, the girl whispered. At least the other people did. My mother said it was bad.
Florida, land of the cow eaters. Only idiots and magicians are from Florida. Orchid kicked her heels on the carpeted ground and rolled her eyes. How he does love strange women. I'm not strange. Orchid ignored her. The point is, I trusted his divine knowledge. He told me he wasn't sick, and I believed him. Only me, because I loved him. Do you know how he felt all those years, when it was only me who believed he was the true king? She leaned back again, waving her hand. Who are you, anyway, to comfort him? You're a child. You have no thoughts of eternity. She put her finger to her lips. When he would go out with the carnivals preaching and cutting heads, before we ever had a carnival of our own, I would wait at the settlement, transforming his scribbles into legibility. His writing is unformed. It is... She reached for the papers and shook one in the air to make her point. I made sense of what he saw in the visions. She paused thoughtfully, her hand lingering on the paper. I've been with him through all that. The girl crossed her arms. Do you love him? She came over to the cage again and picked up the orange-shaped lock and let it fall loudly against the bars, once, then twice. In her thin hand, the gold lock bulged nearly obscenely, and the girl tried to imagine this woman with a sword hacking off heads before a wind-blown crowd and found she could see it better than she would have liked. And then the girl felt a stirring in her chest that was difficult to bear, a renewed awareness of her captivity. The woman clanged the lock again and leaned her face in very close to the bars. Love is impossible without history. That was the very moment when Mr. Capellatio himself strode back into the tent and beheld them at odds, the girl standing on her guard at the center of the cage, and the strange woman with the necklace rattling the lock. He did not meet the girl's eyes, or even look at her. He stared directly at Orchid, who sucked her cheeks in and pursed her lips. They formed a narrow O. You're here, he said easily to her after a long silence. I was out looking for you. I was looking for you, but instead, I found this. She fanned her hand at the cage, but her face remained impassive. You won't even come kiss me? It's been a whole 6 months, Radiance. Come here. He opened his arms. That day he had worn his most spectacular cape, which was the color of goldenrod on the outside and lined with midnight blue, to greet his constituents at the meeting. The girl had watched him pluck the cloak from a trunk, shake it out, and admire himself in the small mirror above his writing desk. He swept this cape behind his shoulders, smiling handsomely. Evidently, his meeting had been a success. Orchid was not smiling. Oh, but you had many other touches, I'm sure, in the meantime. That's the first thing you say to me after 6 months. Orchid's expression became a frown. I shouldn't be saying a single thing to you. I've spent this last half year at my desk, working on the revelations you left in such a half-formed glob, making sense of them and circulating them here, at the risk of my own life, and certainly at the expense of my own happiness. I've spent this last half year readying all this that you see around you, this entire gathering, your constituents from all the corners of the land, and who have met here to defend your cause, because they believe in you and love you, despite dangers and troubles and unknowns. And I come to your tent to find this child? Yes, he was nodding. Another queen. Not any queen, but the queen of our revelation, my queen. What? The girl saw her fingers nodding and unnodding behind her back. The fulfillment of my prophecy. This girl is a solid piece of our destiny. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. He clasped her shoulder. You should have been there. Her appearance, upon the field, in a battle, just as I saw in my head many years ago, in a white gown. Can I help it that she's beautiful? Orchid raised her eyebrows. I was not there, David, because I was here, doing what you needed me to do, here. He wrapped his arms around her with a familiarity that made the girl's heart blacken like meat on a steak. She wished she could turn away, but instead she held on to a cage bar and interlaced her fingers through them as though they could pull her up out of her jealousy. Mr. Capellatio whispered, Perhaps, my love. But I found her just like my vision predicted. I can't take the cape without my divinely appointed queen. It would be madness. The prophecy in the book is certainly not about anyone living now. I should know. I wrote it myself. It would be madness to enter the coming battle with a child by your side instead of me. What are you even thinking? Hear me, Orchid.
You haven't been infallible in the past, have you, dearest? The girl queen we wrote about is not a future queen of a distant age. She's here today, now, in front of you. This is her. That is my interpretation of the passage. Please consider it before giving in to this, unflattering jealousy. How was I to know that you were wrong until I saw that you were wrong with my own eyes, when I saw the girl standing on the field? Orchid said nothing. He said, she was wearing white. Nothing. I trust you. I have trusted you all along. I hope that you trust me, too. Orchid's silence went on too long and seemed like a challenge between them. It's my vision, he said at last. I should be able to interpret it. Orchid whirled on her heels and went back to the books. Oh, no, she repeated again and again, tossing books aside. Oh, no, oh, no, you are wrong, wrong, wrong. You haven't spent time with the words the way I have. You haven't studied them. He went after her and grasped her shoulder, pulling her back. I am not wrong. I'll find it and prove it to you. It says, a young sigil dressed all in white shall appear when at last the rockets have returned to Earth, and this sigil shall sit enthroned during all the days of heaven. She was muttering now. I wrote it 100 times in 100 letters to 100 of your constituents. She looked up, and a plaintive note entered her voice.
Heaven is not now, David.
But how can you know? He asked. She threw some more books from the trunk onto the rugs and kept digging, all the while speaking more angrily. I know, David, because this does not feel like heaven to me. 7 in my own carnival died of bent heads since you left, even though we created more heads this season than we ever have. They did nothing. The disease is still in the ground everywhere, even on the safe roads, no matter what you say. I know, David, because I am still here on this wretched planet with these wretched people, and I am not gliding freely up through the sunshine glare of ozone in a celestial vehicle like you promised, David, she spat. I know, because my own humanity is not disintegrated, is not made perfect. I... Her voice wavered slightly, but when she turned to make what the girl assumed would be a spiteful face, her eyes were dense and unreadable, and showed no emotion at all. The rockets have not returned for us. Mr. Capellatio merely shrugged. I love you dearly. You speak like a warrior scholar. Your gift for translating my words into beautiful writing has gained us thousands of followers. But Radiance, the rockets have returned, as I knew they would, even at the precise time I suspected, and not a minute sooner. I am here at the Cape, and so are they. Orchid's brows knit together. What? Did you stargaze lately? My beautiful wife. Wife of my boyhood. Wife of my first heart. Yesterday, she frowned. No, 2 nights ago. Her face was losing color. The girl knew that Mr. Capellatio looked at the sky every night, without fail. Orchid wiped her forehead with the back of her hand. The days run together. I can't remember. I have been so busy, I... Mr. Capellatio was nodding vigorously. As sometimes happens, we are all busy people, but we shouldn't fall down in our worship ever, especially in this age of times. Our hearts should always be afloat with the ecstasy of shame, which drives us ever toward vigilance. Constance, Radiance, is required of us all. Stop talking like that to me. I was constant. She spread her arms in a helpless flourish, but her voice had weakened. All this carnival, all this. She paused and narrowed her eyes. What is the age of times? A new revelation. Soon we'll write it down together. But now is the time for rejoicing. We will go to the shore and build an altar of oyster shells. Then, tonight, when you go out to look at the heavens, you will see the new light of the first rocket ship. You will know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I am divinely blessed. Tonight, we shall make upon our altar a green phosphorescent flame, and go on a raft into the circle of the sea, and there you, Orchid, priestess wife and scribe, will marry us. You will be her sister, her guidance, her own radiance, as you have been mine. Who better to teach her how to be the king's queen than the king's first wife? Orchid breathed quietly for a few moments. Then she turned to the girl and cried, "Did you hear? Do you understand?" She did not understand. The rockets had returned? Did this mean the world was ending? Or just beginning? Their religion was strange to her, their faith baffling. But she understood that she was important to whatever they believed, just as she understood the look of eagerness in Mr. Capolicio's eyes when he gazed at her. Her mother had said all religions were madness, and here in her cage, the girl thought again she may have been right. Mr. Capolicio unfastened his cape and stood before them both in his beautiful clothes. He opened his arms. After a time, Orchid slipped into them, all the while eyeing the girl with a look not of hate, but of gigantic loss, fresh cut, still squirting. She was not finished with her objections. Far from it. The girl was more scared of her than before. With Mr. Capolicio's back to her, all she saw of him was the way his shoulders curved around Orchid's body, how they formed the top of an inverted triangle, and she saw how strong he was, and she again felt a thrust of agonic jealousy. So she turned her eyes away and did not watch them as they kissed in the low lamplight. She heard their mouths touching wetly together, and when she did finally look, she saw Orchid's eyes blazing at her over his shoulder. Chapter 4. The Comet. It was a lonesome truth that John D. Sousa, chief orbital doctor, astronomer, and scholar of holy texts, named as he was after ancient magicians, both celestial and musical, had still not discovered how to make that which was invisible, visible. Though he used ancient mirrors and water tables, and though he fasted and studied and sacrificed and calculated, he had not yet, in all his years, been able to call down any real revelation. Not a single one. He was now nearly 40, and it was recognition of this monstrous failure that drove him at present to discount the manifold wonders he had created over the course of his life. During his tenure at court, John had adjusted and recast thousands of pages of his predecessor's charts, compiling them finally into what was considered the foremost work of scholarship of the age, a vast, new cosmology of orbits. The book was expansive and contained information from hundreds of places, translated and reinterpreted and reimagined. It was a beautiful work. But now, when John looked at the book, he felt only revulsion. Huge and ungainly, it signified nothing but a torturous waste of his talents, as precise as it was uncreative. They were scientific, but not revelatory. They declared, in short, nothing that was not already known. He continued to pore over texts and pray as though he might yet make some discovery that could give meaning to his life. He still rose every day at the golden dawn and worked some nights straight through until morning again. But in those sweaty, torch-lit hours, John had begun to understand what was perhaps the most lonely truth of all. Failure meant something far worse than he'd imagined as a younger man. For John had tried his entire life to predict the exact day and hour of the return of the rocket ships. But recently, he found himself pursuing this vocation with not a little fear and trembling in the face of the what if. For what if he had indeed succeeded, not in predicting the exact day and hour, but what if he had proved inadvertently that there were no shuttles to begin with, that no such artifacts ever existed? Did John any more believe it was even possible that the shuttles, which were supposed to convey the chosen heavenward into the forever of forevers, were really and truly coming back? If they had ever existed to begin with, why should they return? From where? They would come back to Earth, past the dome of heaven?
Preposterous. The only objects that ever descended were ragged pieces of burnt-up metal from the ancient past. And meteorites. And rain and wind. What if all his scrying and magic and pursuit of the illusory had already revealed an answer? An unpalatable one, but an answer nonetheless. This was the bleak possibility that troubled him more each day. It so happened that in the almanacs John drew up yearly for the court, he included all the changes an observer of the heavens might have occasion to witness, should he turn his eyes to the sky on any given night of the year, constellations, meteor showers, phases of the moon, star risings, and star settings. Though valued by King Michael, who was particularly fond of divination, these predictions were an art to which John had not devoted considerable time in years. The formulas had been worked out centuries before his birth by men with more mathematical genius than himself, and John merely applied them diligently, like a fastidious clerk. They did not engage his imagination or advance his larger quest, which was, of course, the discovery of the return date. So when, on the 14th day of November, after a tedious day of calculating horoscopes for friends and enemies of the crown, John crossed his own small courtyard and happened to glance into his newly filled reflecting pool, he was astonished to see shining in the center of the glassine water a bright, unfamiliar orb. He bent down and looked closer. Under the water were brocaded carp, just purchased for his new manor house. There were arm-thick tubes of variegated flesh, with fins wavering gently in the currentless pond. But atop them, on the water's surface, John saw the unmistakable curve of light that indicated a celestial body in motion. For a long moment, he gazed at that radiant bend and felt nothing. Then a thin panic leapt into his throat, and he realized he had been holding his breath. His heartbeat sped up. He had not forecast this, whatever it was. John flopped back on his behind in the sandy earth and looked upward, finally, searching the sky. He called in a hoarse voice for his servant, Mizar. The man emerged shortly from the gardening shed and brandished a small box, talking as he approached.
"You can see," Mizar barked, "how wonderfully the new pond comets are faring. The colors. This dealer said you cannot find carp this color anywhere, that he has made them himself in his own laboratory specifically for your lordship, and that we should only feed them these."
He opened the wooden box and tilted it downward. John did not look inside, because he was still looking up.
"They are dried and pulverized tadpoles. I will, of course, do the drying and pulverizing myself for subsequent batches, but the catching of the tadpoles might better be assigned to a younger member of your household, although I suppose the exercise would be not so terrible for my..."
And here he gestured to his paunch. John sensed it without even looking.
"Well, I could use it."
Mizar paused and shook the box in John's face, and then pointed to the carp.
"Sir, do you like the pond comets?"
It was Mizar's habit to peck about fretfully. He was as boring as a woman, but John had long ago learned that Mizar had to be extraordinarily annoyed to raise his voice.
"Do you like the new pond comets, sir? They only just arrived today. I acclimated them to the pool as instructed by the breeder, by submerging them in their own separate bowls over the course of 5 hours.
Mizar knelt beside his master and pointed at the pond.
"That is one of the new ones, I believe, with the darker head. Have you ever seen such a lovely fish? I say they were worth every cent."
"Look up, Mizar," John said gloomily.
Mizar glanced at him.
John said, "At the sky, look up."
He shrugged upward. Mizar looked. The white underglobes of his eyes shimmered blue with the condensed light of the skies. He looked back at John. Between them lay some fundamental gulf that John had only ever been able to guess at in moments like this, when he knew himself to be filled with the horror of the possible, and Mizar to be merely amused by it.
"A real comet?" he asked.
"I think so."
"Should that be there? I don't remember anything on the calendar about a comet, not this year or in the next many."
"I know."
John thought suddenly of how he had spent the last several years intensively studying the old texts, revising charts, and inventing new magics to determine the elusive return date. Over these years, he had half convinced the king, and even himself, that there was some way to divine it from nothing. Lately, his search had grown more esoteric, and as he became desperate to prove to himself that the shuttles had in fact existed, he'd begun pursuing the line of thought that the date might be revealed by some unearthly entity through channeling. He also wondered if the date had already been disclosed, somewhere, somehow, to someone else. He only needed to learn where and how it had been communicated. It was a somewhat ludicrous hope, but anything was possible, wasn't it? He had once believed so. But many nights in his office he had looked through his window, out onto his private courtyards and slumbering astronomical apparatuses, and had pounded his fists because he could not understand everything all at once. No, not even a sliver of it. His mind was simply too small, and he fell into despair that he had spent his life in pursuit of folly. Mizar coughed.
"Could it be a fall of metal, sir? Perhaps just an old object coming down from the orbits?"
"It could be." John was himself an expert in metal falls, which occurred when fragments of the ancient satellites crashed back to Earth. The recovery of these relics was deeply important to King Michael, who ordered each one studied and catalogued. John was less interested in the physical aspects of the heavens than in theoretical ones, and so had little energy for the king's insistence that these misshapen twists of metal meant anything at all, but he understood their importance as devotional objects, and so kept a collection of interesting specimens in a cabinet in his offices.
"Should I bring your telescope?" asked Mizar.
"I doubt it will help."
"Do you want your books? This may be in the charts. Perhaps the printer of the calendar made the error, not yourself."
"It's not the printer's fault."
Mizar stood and his knees cracked.
"Well, what should I do?"
He looked unconcernedly again at the blazing arc. John waved his arms as he was given to doing when he felt hopeless, standing up so quickly he felt dizzy.
"What? You ask me what? Here we have some phenomenon of a magnitude I cannot gauge, and you want to know what is to be done? You know, Mizar, what is a word I am now just rethinking, and I..."
He put his head in his hands.
"I need to go to my study." "What?" he sniffed. "I am surrounded by low, hideous persons with visions only of what?"
Mizar sneezed to cover a laugh.
"What then should I ask, sir, if not what?" "Well, certainly not the obvious. Why?"
John said, and squinted at the sky.
"And any idiot might ask how. You, Mizar, are not quite that much of an idiot, so I believe you will refrain from asking stupid questions, if only for my sake. But..."
John felt his insides burning with confusion, for the reality of this streak of light was concrete. It existed, and he had not predicted it.
"Perhaps even a half-wit such as yourself might stumble instinctively upon the correct question, or through a process of elimination might arrive at it. What, Mizar, do you think that question might be?"
Mizar's cheeks did not flush. He was a good servant, impervious to verbal cruelty. John had, in times of greater despair than this, cast his fury upon Mizar like a club, pummeling him with the hugeness of his own fear and pain, while Mizar cheerfully clucked on about selecting an entree for a dinner party or the soil in the garden beds. It was easy for John to believe Mizar had no concerns beyond the domestic. He truthfully considered him a kind of genius, though he would never have admitted it aloud. Mizar shrugged narrowly.
"I believe the word you're after, sir, must be who, since you have kindly exhausted all the other alternatives for me."
John closed and opened his eyes.
"Yes," he said, "you're right. Who?"
"Well,
who what?" "Who predicted this light, if anyone? I surely didn't. Better yet, who can explain it?" Who is the person I should write to first, and who is most qualified to interpret the meaning of this occurrence? Who is the fastest courier we have?
John's mind